Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is actually a Resuscitation Leadership Academy lecture. That's right, the RLA. If you want more information about that, just come over to the show notes. For this, I will put it at the site of where the blog post normally would be, mcrit.org/154, mcrit.org/154, and you could hear this RLA lecture and then find out more about the Resuscitation Leadership Academy. If you want to go beyond just a superficial discussion of resuscitation and want a real in-depth one-year virtual fellowship, then that's the place to go. Enough about that. Let's get to this. The reason I'm doing an RLA lecture and putting it up on the podcast is twofold. One, to let you know about the RLA, but more importantly, it's that both groups have asked me for this, and I cannot allow either group to go wanting. So when I was at SMAC in Chicago, you know, the best conference in the universe, I hosted a panel of some of the smartest people in the world of sepsis critical care. These people were brilliant, that concentrated glowing brilliance on the stage all at one time. I thought it wouldn't support it. I got these folks a little bit drunk and we talked about sepsis care. And from the conference, I got the most feedback on, can you please parse through the things that were said in that panel and help us understand what the hell we're actually supposed to be doing on sepsis patients now? Because the panel kind of blew apart many of the preconceived notions and many of the guidelines on sepsis care. And that's what I want to do. Now, normally these smackbacks happen after the release of the actual lecture or recording of the talk or panel. We're going to do that differently. We're going to precede it just because I continue to get emails saying, please, please, could you make some sense of this for us? So that's what we're going to do today. So the first thing brought up on the panel is, how do we identify septic patients? And there's been some panning of the SIRS criteria. In fact, there was a recent article released in the New England Journal, and a link for that will be in the show notes, saying that SIRS is no good. SIRS is insensitive, that patients are going to die of sepsis, and SIRS will not pick them up. And that was being a big impetus to get rid of the SIRS criteria. I'm not so sure. When you look at that article, SIRS criteria in their current unadulterated form, 88% sensitive. I actually look at that and say, damn, that's better than I thought. This is pretty good. Now, supposedly what's going to put the SIRS criteria out to pasture is something called sepsis 3.0, which is essentially tachypnea, altered mental status, or hypotension in the setting of suspected infection. Well, the SIRS criteria has most of those, but forget about the SIRS criteria. I don't use the SIRS criteria. I use the modification of the SIRS criteria that we created for our Greater New York Hospital Association Sepsis Collaborative, the Stop Sepsis Collaborative in NYC, which you've heard about if you've been listening to the podcast. And that criteria actually has altered mental status and hypotension already there. And we eliminated the need for getting a WBC count. I'm pretty happy. I feel that our collaborative, not me, but the collaborative has been pretty prescient in predicting the way these things will go. And we don't have to change a thing in New York City because our criteria already have it. Now, our criteria may be overly sensitive because we have some things on there that are not on the sepsis 3.0, if those actually come to pass, I'm okay with that. All that these criteria do for me is make me ask myself, is this patient severely septic, and to send a lactate? And we'll talk about in a second why I think both of those things are great, and I will be happy to have overly sensitive criteria that lead me to do those two things. Think about whether the patient actually is severe sepsis and send a lactate. Either of those things, all good. I'm not changing a thing based on this panel for my identification. I'm still going to use the Greater New York Hospital Association modified Stop Sepsis SIRS criteria, and I will feel very good about doing so after the current evidence came out and after the panel has weighed in, and Sepsis 3.0 won't change that at all. So check those out, mcrit.org/154, and you will see the Greater New York Hospital Association modified criteria, and I think you will feel good about whatever you're doing in your hospital. I think you probably should add altered mental status to your list, and I think you should add hypotension to your list, and then you are golden. And the way we did it is we didn't even ask for suspected infection because we wanted to use this as a triage criteria, And therefore, sometimes at triage, they don't really know because they haven't gotten the whole 10-minute story from the patient. They're getting a 2-minute story. So we have suspected infection as one of 3 criteria, which keeps it the same as infection plus 2 modified SIRS or infection plus 2 sepsis 3.0 criteria, but even makes it more sensitive because without infection, if you have any 3 criteria, you still get put into getting a questioning of this patient, perhaps some early fluid administration, and sending a lactate. Okay, I'm not going to belabor that any further. If you want to see more, go to the show notes. Okay, topic number 2 that was brought up on the panel was actually once you've identified a septic patient or you have a presumed septic patient, how do you figure out whether they're severe sepsis? And this is far more interesting to me than the initial screening for a sepsis patient. The definition that was classically used from early goal-directed therapy, which was made up, but made up based on a lot of evidence and has stuck with us, is a lactate greater than or equal to 4 millimoles per liter or hypotension after the initial fluid resuscitation. This is the definition I've been working with for 15 years. This is the definition that when I was doing quality assurance for sepsis at my former hospital before Janus General, we were using. But we didn't just stop there. We actually went further and looked at all the ICD-9 or soon to be ICD-10 sepsis cases, patients who were upgraded to the unit when initially put on the floor. We looked at all those patients. This definition worked, at least in my hospital. It was the definition used in the triad of 3 major further sepsis trials, PROCESS, PROMISE, and ARISE. They all use this as their entrance criteria. And so all of the major really good evidence on sepsis has this as the definition of severity. And my experience as a clinician is this is a fantastic definition of who is severe sepsis. You either get hypotensive after fluids. So it's not just initial hypotension, because a lot of these you give a liter of fluid and they're done. They're golden. They have never have a problem again. Or a lactate greater than or equal to 4. That's the definition we have evidence for. People are trying to change this definition. I understand why. Wouldn't it be great if you have a patient who is not generating a lactate, but not yet hypotensive, and you could find that patient and actually treat them early, before they even get the hypotension? It sounds good. There's not great evidence for this. And we all agree that severe sepsis is organ dysfunction initiated by sepsis. But to actually put numbers to this, or as is the case starting in October in the United States, to make it national regulatory policy and make it something that your payments are based on, I'm not sure where that's coming from. And so what you want to do is go to mcrit.org/154, and you will see Table 2 from the Surviving Sepsis Campaign. You'll also see a post I wrote about what's going to happen in October. And there's all sorts of things there, like a creatinine level, which seems arbitrarily set at a number, platelets, all sorts of things, which in essence I agree with, because these are the various organs that could be affected by sepsis. But in quantitative terms, to say this is the same as a patient whose lactate's greater than 4 or persistently hypotensive does not make sense to me. These patients may not be the same. We don't know. We need a study. We need a study showing not just that these things are associated with death, but that treating these patients aggressively with severe sepsis therapies actually make a mortality difference. And if we don't have that evidence, then we shouldn't be held to these things. This is, as I originally interpreted it when Surviving Sepsis Campaign first came out, as, you know, some little things to remind you, wow, be a little bit wary of this patient. That's how I looked at it when the guidelines were first published, I think, 2012. And I think they're great for that. You know, if you see a patient who had no renal failure in the past and their creatinine suddenly 3, that may be a patient you should keep your eye on. That may be a patient you should trend some lactates and see if eventually they do reach the threshold of 4. But to say now all of a sudden these patients are severe sepsis and require aggressive therapies, maybe. But you need to show me some evidence for that. And I'm kind of irked that table now has become the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services marker of severe sepsis. And we're expected to do all sorts of things, all sorts of hoop jumping based on that. I'm not going to belabor this any further because you should just read the We Are Complicit post I'll have linked. But I'm scared about what this will do. I think this is going to be a debacle. I think the only way that any hospital will be able to meet these new guidelines is to just empirically give broad spectrum antibiotics. This is similar to the debacle of pneumonia in the United States, you know, 6-7 years ago, where we were just giving Biaxin or damn, what's the generic name? I'm not supposed to use brand names on this. Is that clarithromycin? To patients at triage or in the waiting room so that we can meet it. Now, all of a sudden, we're going to be giving these patients Vanco and piperacillin tazobactam at triage because there's no way, given the crap in this table, that you're going to be able to meet a deadline for antibiotics any other way. So essentially, we are going back to horrible empiric care as opposed to doing what we're supposed to be doing. And one thing that came out of this panel, one thing that was repeated time and time again on this panel is the way to treat severe sepsis patients is to just be a good resuscitationist. Every single person on the panel said the same thing. Don't use guidelines, use your clinical judgment. And we're going to lose the ability to use clinical judgment with these new markers of severity. Right now, I am very happy with lactate greater than or equal to 4 or persistent hypotension until someone shows me something better. So that's that for the panel discussion. And most of the panelists, you know, said the same thing. Now, where we have to have a discussion, though, on is lactate, because people are misunderstanding lactate. People are bashing lactate. People are saying get rid of lactate. And this is a complete misunderstanding. You know, unfortunately, my friend Paul Marek is at the real forefront of this, and I'm not sure where Paul is going. You see, you have to separate lactate into two things. Lactate as a screen of severity, and then lactate clearance as a marker of goodness. And those two are entirely separate. And I have seen nothing to say that an elevated lactate in a septic patient greater than or equal to 4 is not a fantastic marker of sepsis severity. Every study that's looked at this has shown an association with elevated lactate and death, badness. The higher the lactate goes, the more that association becomes true. And all of the debate has seemed to be a straw man debate on what actually is generating that lactate. And we discussed this on the panel. You know, is it hyperperfusion? Yes, sometimes, in probably a smaller percentage of the patient. Is it a rev up of the adrenergic system and other various ileumers causing a difference in the normal metabolism and shunting more of the sugar metabolism to lactate? That is probably a vast majority. Don't care. Never cared about that for the things I've been saying about lactate being good as a marker of severity. It doesn't matter what's generating the lactate. What we know is that if your lactate is high, you have a tendency to die. If your lactate is high, you have a tendency to die when you are starting off the screening for severity of a septic patient. It doesn't mean a patient with a elevated lactate has sepsis. No one's saying that. Lactate is for the decision of severity once you've already determined a patient is septic. And for that, I think it's great. And I've seen nothing to the contrary. And until I do, lactate will absolutely be in my severity screening protocol for sepsis and send a lot of lactates. I like them. If it turns out not to be sepsis, if it turns out to be some other SIRS-inducing situation, an elevated lactate's still really bad and still demands you look at that patient and probably treat them aggressively. There are a few confounders, like the patient just seized unbeknownst to you just before they arrived, or they're an asthmatic who's used a ton of albuterol or Proventil. I'm not sure which of those is the generic just before arrival. But for the most part, I want to know that the lactate's 6, and that's usually a marker of badness. I'm not going to belabor this any further. Please do not confuse lactate clearance with lactate as a marker of severity, and please don't confuse the fact that there are many causes in a septic patient for the lactate being high as a reason not to use the lactate. I hope that really gets this across. One more thing on that, and just in terms of a change in terminology, which was subtle, but I thought fantastic, and really just like, you know, little fireworks burst in my head. And I'm not sure if it was said by Merv Singer or Simon Finfer. I think it was one of the two of them. Let's stop thinking about this as severe sepsis, and let's think about it as infection plus hypotension, as just something that cues you to badness. Infection plus hypotension. That's good. I like that. And, you know, that infection plus hypotension or infection plus let's just call it elevated lactate above 4 so we don't get into that morass of terminology. That's it. Those are good ways of thinking about it. All right. Antibiotics. This is weird. Here's the thing. We all intuitively feel broad spectrum antibiotics that treat every possible source is a good thing to do in a severely septic patient. But we don't have great evidence for that. Here's what we have evidence for. If you have septic shock, and I am not defining this the ridiculous way the CMS is defining this as including lactate. When I say septic shock, I mean persistent hypotension with infection or persistent hypotension with sepsis. If you have a septic shock patient, there is an association with early antibiotics, appropriate antibiotics, leading to better outcome in terms of mortality. And I buy that. There's nothing to say if your lactate's 5 and you give antibiotics at that moment that those patients have an association with mortality. We still think it's a good idea. And I would say give empiric broad spectrum antibiotics to any patient who's severely septic. But the only evidence we have is for hypotension. And what we certainly don't have evidence for is that broad-spectrum antibiotics will help the patients with the new CMS definitions of severe sepsis. And in fact, I think while it may not hurt them in individual patients, in aggregate, this will be atrocious. This will be horrible. We will be killing our antibiotic supply if we're not already doing it fantastically already of just destroying the ability of antibiotics to actually kill bugs. We're going to do it with this new definition of severe sepsis because it essentially means, you know, any lab perturbation will now be getting broad spectrum antibiotics. This will be horrible. So be aware. The evidence is there for hypotension, i.e. septic shock. It's a good idea, I think, to give it to any patient who's severely septic. And I think it's a really bad idea to give it to any patient who's infected until you have more information or really understand what's going on with the patient. Now, what I will say in terms of being a little more profligate is if I have any patient with unexplained hypotension, I have a hair trigger to give those patients antibiotics. And we are finding out more and more that regardless of the etiology for why that patient's hypotensive, in most cases, antibiotics will usually turn out to be a good idea. Which is not to say if you have a patient with unknown source of hypotension and they turn out to have a P, you help them at all by giving them antibiotics. But for the most part, most of the things that give you hypotension persistent after fluids benefit from antibiotics. So, they turn out to have a intra-abdominal viscous rupture. Well, it may not have initially been sepsis, but you certainly wanted to give that patient preoperative antibiotics. Score. Patient turned out to be a GI bleed as the source of their hypotension. Well, if it was from varices, those antibiotics were super helpful and probably far more mortality preventing than things like PPIs or octreotide. So score. If it turned out to be some other cause, well, you're probably not going to cause any harm. But if it does turn out to be sepsis, and so many of these undifferentiated hypotensions do, then you probably, if you're going to do anything for these septic patients, saved a life by giving earlier antibiotics once they're hypotensive. So here's the thing. Any patient who I have undifferentiated hypotension, meaning I've done my rush exam, I've looked for a source, I can't figure it out, but they still keep dropping their BP, I am giving broad spectrum antibiotics, and I am feeling very good about doing it in this population. The other thing that came out in the panel was, look, if you give an individual patient one or two doses of antibiotics and it turns out they weren't that severe or it turns out they were something else, you probably have not done any harm even to the antibiotic supply because those one or two doses probably are not breeding resistance. So if you have doubt, give antibiotics, give them broadly. But if you know your patient is not severe sepsis, you know they just have a normal pneumonia, then maybe narrow down the spectrum a little bit to just the sources of community-acquired pneumonia, and maybe you don't give that Vanco, which is, you know, what I do in every severe sepsis pneumonia, even from the community, because I'm treating things like community-acquired MRSA. And I should say, if you have questions about any of this, or I'm missing points, or I'm not understanding something, and you get it, please put it in the comments, mcrit.org/154. The next thing we spoke about on the panel was fluids. And this has been a paradigm-shifting area of sepsis care for me and many of my friends, I think. And the entire panel seemed pretty down on fluids for sepsis, maybe with the exception of Flavia, but even she says we might, you know, have to moderate a little bit, if I remember the panel correctly. And these guys, I'm sure, will correct me if I'm wrong. But we may be swinging the pendulum too far. Here's the deal. We have a lot of associative evidence that fluids in sepsis may be bad if they're being given when the patient doesn't actually need them. And, you know, things like the FEAST trial make us a little bit leery of just giving enormous amounts of fluid. Now, that being said, you know, when I first started as a whelp, when I was an intern, we were giving no fluids. I don't think those patients did so well either. And then we have all this evidence on the fact that the initial response to vasopressors is to squeeze the venous side, not the arterial side, and therefore make the huge swimming pool you need to fill that much smaller. And so the fluids you do actually give will actually augment preload far more effectively, and that you're not decreasing organ perfusion by giving pressors. You may be increasing it by getting more blood back to the heart, by changing the unstressed volume in the venous side to the stress volume, shrinking down the capacitance, and doing all sorts of good things for cardiac output without having to give fluids. And a lot of people on the panel, you know, Paul Marek and others, John Myberg, they all said that sepsis is not a fluid-depleted state. It's just fluid translocated elsewhere, and therefore giving fluids doesn't make sense. And now, I'm kind of riding the fence on this one. I have full equipoise on this issue, and I, therefore, would be happy, in fact, overjoyed to randomize my severe sepsis patients to a fluid-tight to fluid-loose study. I would love that. I think it needs to be done. I think we are finally at the point where we can do it, where we could get this past an IRB to randomize patients to some, you know, maybe the 4 liters, 4.5 liters that came out of every single major sepsis trial versus a much tighter, you know, 1.5, 2 liter, and see which patients do better. And gosh, I hope, you know, ANZIX or some other super smart group does this study, because it can be done now. I think we have evidence on either side to say it's fair to the patients to do it. Until then, I am not as tight as some of my comrades, but I am not as loose either. Here's my thoughts. And let me preface those thoughts with a story. And this is pure anecdote, and it has no bearing on anything. I just think it was a little bit interesting to have some personal experience with this. So about 6 months ago, I came into the Janus General, and right before I got there, I was just feeling not so great. I just felt run down. I was a little bit out of it. I thought, hey, maybe I'm coming down with a cold. And on the car ride on the way over, I you know, arrived in the parking lot, and I just could not get out of the car. I felt like death, and I felt a little bit nauseous and just a little bit dizzy, but the real feeling was just the overwhelming sense that I cannot get up. I felt like I wanted to die. I felt horrible, and I got on shift, and I was taking my sign out, and I just could not lift my hand off the arm of the chair to like put my pen to paper. And I had never felt so bad in my life. And I took some Tylenol and I was sucking it up, and just getting out of the chair to see the patients my residents presented. Wow. It was, you know, more work than, you know, an hour long kettlebell session. And I just did not know what was going on with me. I knew there was some kind of GI virus going around, and some of my colleagues had been calling in sick, and I just figured that's what I had, and it probably is what I had. I wound up vomiting once, and it was just, and I'm sorry for sharing this with you, but it's pertinent to the story. It was just small volume. I lost no fluids. And there was no further vomiting after that. There was no diarrhea. I felt a little bit better after vomiting, as you so often do, but still like death. And now I've been drinking enormous quantities of fluid to try to rehydrate. I think I probably took in 2 or 3 liters of water orally. Finally, I just broke down and had one of the nurses put a line in. And I took 3 liters of fluid. After those 3 liters, felt like $1 million. That's overplaying my cards, but I felt pretty good. I was able to finish that shift. I didn't have to call in sick and bring someone in at 2 a.m. I was able to move around. I didn't urinate for, I think, 14 hours. Again, sorry for sharing this, but I think it's part of the story. And I was puffy. I mean, when I got home after that shift, I had edema even on my arms. It wasn't just dependent edema. Those 3 liters had definitively gone to my interstitium. I was edematous. It wasn't until I woke up the next day that I first urinated. And so here's the deal. Why am I telling you this story with some gross, overly personal details? I obviously was not fluid down. I had, you know, the vomiting, like I had said, small volume. I probably had lost maybe, I don't know, 50, 100 cc's. No diarrhea. Felt like death. Got the fluid. Probably all went to my interstitium. All immediately left the vascular space. But felt amazing. Now, maybe it's just that I felt better and wouldn't have mattered one way or another. But here's what I could tell you. I don't think we have the answers on how fluids work in sepsis. I don't think the fact that we probably now know that most of the fluid third spaces, we don't know whether that's good or bad. We say it's bad. It seems bad. Intuitively, it feels bad, and it may turn out to be bad. I don't think the answers are all in. I don't think we should change our practice until that RCT is done, because I don't know the real mechanisms at work here. I think we should not give excess fluid. I don't think we should give no fluid. And so here's how I think we should play it. I still think every patient should get 30 mLs per kg. I really do. That's not that much fluid. That's 2 liters. And I think every patient with severe sepsis, the way I define it, should get that pretty much off the bat. That should just be your initial default setting. I think if you're capable of doing ultrasound, then looking at the combination of the heart, the IVC, and the lungs will guide your further fluid. I think if you can't do that, giving an empiric additional 1 to 2 liters makes a lot of sense. And I think most patients with severe sepsis should get 4 liters of fluid if you're doing it empirically, or 3 to 4 liters if you're not. You know, there will be patients who, just based on their right heart, their IVC, and their lungs, probably should just stop at that 30 mLs per kg. I don't have a problem intubating a patient as a result of those 3 to 4 liters. And in fact, many cases, if a patient can't tolerate 3 or 4 liters of fluid without going into pulmonary edema, intubation was probably what that patient needed regardless. And it would probably be a poor move not to intubate that patient, i.e. your CHFers, your patients with poor ejection fraction, your end-stage renal disease patients. I think intubating those guys early if they can't tolerate 3 liters of fluid was probably the wisest move and probably will save a life. I think that's where a lot of our benefit in the sepsis collaborative was, is that earlier intubation done safely is smarter than later intubation done horribly. But I am not there at the give 1 liter of fluid and then put them on vasopressors. I am not any longer thinking I would ever, ever give 8 to 10 liters of fluid without them on vasopressors. But 3 or 4 liters and then vasopressors before any additional fluid, or maybe no additional fluid, just titrate the vasopressors at that point, makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that's what I'm recommending. And I think that's what our collaborative has been recommending. And I really feel good about it after the triad of trials, process, promise, ARISE. The fact that in all of those, and especially ARISE coming out of Australia, that the patients all got 4 liters of fluid makes me feel so good. It makes me laugh. It makes me make fun of Chris Nixon. And I would never make fun of John Myberg, but makes me just internally chuckle a little bit. Come on, guys. You know, you say we're so ridiculous in the U.S. giving this excess fluid, and then you guys gave the exact same amount. 4 liters seems quite right to me, and that's what I think you should be doing. 3 or 4 liters of fluid, at least 30 mLs per kg of fluid, and then automatic vasopressors if they are still dropping their blood pressure or not going where you want them to go in terms of lactate clearance or other markers that you are using. Whatever you decide to use as your mark of the patient getting better, if they're not getting better, you probably deserve to put those patients on low-dose pressors. All right, now we need to then talk about something which I think is a barrier, and this barrier needs to be smacked out. And that barrier is, I think people are doing dumb things with fluids simply to avoid having to put the patient on vasopressors, to avoid having to put the patient in a higher level of care. This is problematic. And I see this at the Janus General, is that patients, I know, it's not just like, you know, going down the Marek-Myberg route of saying, oh, I don't want to give this patient another liter beyond their 2 liters because I think fluids are pure evil. No, it's patients like, I've given 3 liters of fluid to. And now I look, their IVC is not moving at all with respiration. Their heart is totally filled. And the consultants want to still give additional fluid, even in the case where we have clear, you know, echo and ultrasound evidence that they're probably not going to benefit, even from whatever limited benefit there may be, and they still want to get fluid. And why? Because they want to put the patient on a regular bed, and they don't want to put them in an ICU. This, I think, is really bad care. Here's what I could tell you, and this came out in the panel. Peripheral vasopressors are okay. We had the initial Ricard randomized controlled trial, and now we have my friend Paul Mayo out of the LIJ, along with Seth Koenig, demonstrating and more additional safety information. I will put that article at mcurt.org/154. Read it. It's huge. It's excellent. It's fantastic work. And it says you could give peripheral vasopressors. I do this short term, and then I put a line in them after, you know, a few hours if they still need it. Paul would tell you don't need to do that at all. Just keep them on it for 2 days if you want. And this should allow you to take a septic patient and make protocols in your hospital that, like, if you're requiring less than whatever arbitrary cutoff you want, let's say 5 micrograms per minute of norepi, you should be able to get them peripherally and you should be able to get them on the floor. And this will stop so much stupidity in sepsis care where it's like, oh no, give them their 6th liter, their 7th liter, their 8th liter of fluid, all in attempt not to put them in an ICU bed. Please, let's make this happen. Let's say peripheral norepi through a good line, or what we may be moving to through a midline, 5 micrograms or less, gets you on the floor. Make it a, you know, minimal titration, otherwise the nurses can't handle it. And then if they start requiring more than that, if their pressures start dropping, then put them in an ICU. This will do a lot of good, I think. What's your choice of vasopressor? It should be norepi initially. I think most of the panel agreed with that, with the alternative being epinephrine. Not dopamine. Everyone on the panel agreed, no dopamine. So either norepi as my preference or epi. Either one is fine. My friend Josh Farkas actually did a fantastic post talking about this. I'm not going to go through all of it now, but it is absolutely worth reading. Just go to mcrit.org/154 and you will find that post, and you could find out what pressors you should be starting and why maybe you should be starting vaso right up front with your norepi at the bat, and maybe earlier epi. And you'll see all the reasons he has for that on his post. Okay, so that's vasopressors, how to give them, which ones to give. The next thing we talked about is how do you know if the patient is getting better? Now, traditionally, early goal-directed therapy told you SCVO2. I think everyone agreed you don't need that. Sometimes I like getting it, just not on every patient. Some patients, it's a nice number to have. Just like every number is nice to have. I'll take CVP, give it to me. Am I going to use that as a absolute arbiter of fluid administration? Hell no. But if you put a CVP up, I'll look at that number. I'll put that in the context of all the rest of the things I'm looking at the patient. Sure, knock yourself out. Got no problem taking any numbers because I know how to interpret them. That's what you're supposed to be doing. You can take a number and use it to its best advantageous benefit to your patient and not use it as just a idiot, how should I phrase this? You know, these aren't idiot boxes that just let you, 7, here's what we do. 10, here's what you do. No, just use it physiologically. Lactate clearance, I don't know. We put out a abstract at the last SMAC saying that clearing your lactate didn't lead you to do any better than the patients that didn't clear your lactate in severe sepsis. But we also showed that if your lactate cleared and then got worse, your mortality spiked up radically. So maybe there is value. I still do it. I don't think we should require it. I think if people want to use a pure, you know, process-based clinical assessment and not ever send a repeat lactate, they are totally evidence-supported by the triad of trials. And I don't think we should mandate it. Now, why do I say this? Well, both CMS and now the American College of Emergency Physicians will be mandating that you get lactate clearance and that you clear it by 10%. And there's really no evidence for this. Alan Jones's fantastic work on this simply said it's no worse than the SVO2 of the early goal-directed therapy trial. It didn't show it's actually beneficial compared to just using clinical gestalt. So we shouldn't be mandating this. And there, the ASEP stuff is actually in public comment mode right now. So you should definitely go over there if you have any interest in sepsis and get rid of those. Get rid of the repeat lactate mandate and the clearance by 10% mandate. Please, please do that because we just look silly. I'm so sick of looking silly and making quality assurance crap when the horse has already left the barn. We just had the three trials saying that repeat lactates and lactate clearance of 10% totally unnecessary. And now we're going to make a frigging quality assurance measure based on it. Come on, guys. Come on. Go to the public commenting, my MCRIT friends, and just get rid of this crap. We just look silly. Hate it. All right. No, I don't have any stake in this at all, right? Okay. So how do you know if they're better? Well, if you don't want to use lactate, and like I say, I still send it. But if you don't want to use it, well, the patient's mentating, they're peeing, their numbers are looking better, their vitals are looking better. The patient has just that feeling of, wow, they turned the corner, which anyone who's an experienced resuscitationist knows. You walk in the room of the patient who formerly looked like they were going to die, and now they look good, and everything's going well. They're probably getting better, and that's probably all you need. So that's how you know they're better. All right, what we didn't talk about on the panel I had on my list, we ran out of time, steroids. Josh Farkas has another post on this. It actually might even be the same post, it's two separate posts. Read that. That will give you a good indication. I am still giving steroids. Unlike Josh, I am giving them when I am getting up to the higher ranges of my norepinephrine. He doesn't like that idea. I think it actually makes some sense based on my interpretation of the evidence, but I still think steroids definitely have a role. And if you wanted to give them earlier than we're used to after the Corticus trial, you might be supported by evidence. And then we talk about guidelines. People keep getting guidelines wrong. People keep thinking guidelines should supplant clinical judgment. My whole OODA loop talk that got destroyed by technical difficulties at SMAC was on this topic in the setting of trauma, but just as applicable to sepsis. Guidelines should say, if you are a novice or you just want a baseline of what to do in patients, here's what to do. And then if your clinical judgment supersedes that, you should just be able to write, my clinical judgment supersedes that. Any guideline that doesn't have that is going to fail, is going to be bad care, and it's really driving me nuts. Surviving Sepsis campaign everywhere should say, unless supplanted by clinical judgment. The CMS measure should say, unless supplanted by clinical judgment. And the ACEP guideline should say, unless supplanted by clinical judgment. And everything every member of the panel said was, the clinical judgment of an expert intensivist or resuscitationist is what you should be using to determine what to do on your individual patient with severe sepsis. So for the love of all good in the world, could we make that happen? If you have any control over these various guidelines, could you please talk to these folks? I just had a conversation with some of the folks from the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines, and I just wanted to bang my head against the wall because what this person, who is like one of the lead people in Surviving Sepsis, kept saying is, yeah, use your clinical judgment. This is probably good guidelines for a aggregate if you have doctors that don't have a fantastic expertise, but use clinical judgment, use clinical judgment, use clinical judgment, except nowhere in those guidelines, Surviving Sepsis Campaign, CMS, or ACEP, are they letting us use our clinical judgment. So gosh, let's fix this. You know, my post on this topic was called We Are Complicit, because we are complicit. We as a group of physicians could fix all this. The bean counters don't make this stuff. We make this stuff, and we let people in our own specialties F this up. We got to stop. All right, we're at the 40-minute mark. This is normal for an RLA lecture. It's double the size of a normal MCRIT lecture, so I'm going to, you know, really split the difference between the two and stop there. And please, I'm sure you have comments. I'm sure you have things you disagree with. Put them at mcrit.org/154. Even if you're in the RLA, put them there so that everyone else could benefit from your knowledge or thoughts. mcrit.org/154. This is Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast and the RLA saying bye-bye.